Hello, it's Debbie back on Wednesday, September 9th, reading from the HeraldReview.com website for today. Beginning with news from local news says Meridian opens new buildings for New Year. Macon, the bell for first period at Meridian High School rang at 7:46 a.m. Tuesday, and with that loud alert, years of planning, construction, and $45 million were put into action. High school and elementary school students arriving for their first day of school were met by a brand new school and plenty of staff directing them where to go. Principal Eric Horelbrink said the energy felt different than other first days. Plans for the Meridian School District to renovate and convert four outdated facilities into two new buildings, one an elementary school students, the other a junior-senior high school, were confirmed in 2011. The district broke ground in spring of 2012. Despite the newness of gleaming green walls and polished floors, there were signs of more work to come. Christy Fold's contractors could be seen outside working on the football field. Tables were crunched into makeshift cafeteria as a temporary wall blocked off the rest of the lunchroom, new auditorium, library, and art classrooms. The first and only home football game this year will be October 16th, which pushed back homecoming a month. It could have been ready, but it wasn't going to be ready enough, Hulbrink said. On his desk, an office that overlooks the football fields is a map of the school and all its new furniture. He points to the blocked-off library and auditorium expected to be complete by the end of October. The next challenge is getting people moved into these spaces, Horelbrink said. As for the first day, he said it was going better than he even hoped, with positive reactions from parents, students, and teachers. I am super excited to be in the labs because previously we were in the home economics room, said physics and chemistry teacher Kelly Harms, who had been with the district for 8 years. She had a long list of things she was excited for, including air conditioning, natural lighting from the large classroom windows, flexible lab stations, a built-in fume hood for experiments, and the chance to build a robot on the first class day of class. I wanted to engage the students and do more hands-on activity, Harms said. The first day is when I'll have their undivided attention. Construction was also still evident at the new Meridian Elementary School building in Blue Mound, where workers hustled around two new playgrounds before the first day of recess. They're putting mulch down as we speak, Principal Lori Gubert said Tuesday morning. Teachers have been on site for 2 weeks getting used to the more open concept where hallways open into common spaces that can be used for small groups or students who need help. The elementary building is connected to the middle school, where students will stay until moving over to the new site in January. After that, it'll be demolished, opening up the space for parking lot. Right now, one of our obstacles is parking, Gubert said. Michelle Traster came in before the first bell at the high school to sign off on her son's contract for using a Chromebook because she wasn't able to attend orientation. This year, every high school student's getting one of the laptops to use in school and at home. When asked if he was looking forward to the first day and the new building, Elijah Bolliard replied with a shrug, "And it's school," before heading off to find his first class. His mom was more excited. We've seen this wing, but all this furniture is new and all the parking, Traster said, recognizing the new student and staff lots. Besides passing out the remaining laptops, Technology Director Phil Stilo greeted students and provided directions. For a lot of kids, this is their first time in the building, said Stilo, who visited over the summer to see it being built. I'm glad it's finally here. End of article, which is by the staff writer for the Herald and Review, Emily Steele. Next article, full day preschool at Southeast keeps kids learning. This is by Valerie Wells for the Herald and Review. Decatur. It takes a lot of energy to teach a room full of four-year-olds, but it also takes a lot of energy to be a four-year-old. We have rest time every day, said Jessica Cameron, who teaches one of the classes at Southeast Learning Center. These kids do a lot of resting. The Decatur School District received a grant from the Illinois State Board of Education for 4 new preschool classrooms to provide an all-day program for at-risk 4-year-olds. The program is housed at Southeast School, which also houses a special education alternative placement program in another wing. Phoenix Academy, which used the building the last few years, has moved to the Alternative Education Center on East El Dorado Street. I'm going to read that again. There's a lot of information in that paragraph. The preschool program is housed at Southeast School, which also houses the Special Education Alternative Placement Program in another wing. Phoenix Academy, which used the building the past few years, has moved to the Alternative Education Center on East El Dorado Street. Cameron has 2 teaching assistants, one who spends all day with her and one she shares with another classroom. "We are busy from the time we come in," Cameron said. "We work on fine motor skills at the table, and lately we've been playing a lot with links where you connect them together. We have our morning meeting where we talk about what day it is, and we work on patterns and colors and shapes and weather, and we sing every morning. The most important lessons are less tangible," Cameron said. The kids are learning to play nicely together, to listen, to get along, and to be a good friend, one of their most important lessons. Those social and emotional skills are critical to a good transition into kindergarten and the academic demands they'll face there," she said. Early childhood coordinator Christine Law said the full day is a long one for 4-year-olds, but in a typical preschool program, a couple hours a day isn't enough to allow for the teaching of those important skills. All the time is taken up with academic pursuits. "The idea is to give a jump start to those most at-risk kids," she said. "Instead of being a half-day program, they're here from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., and they get breakfast, they get lunch, they get a snack before they go home, so they're getting their nutrition. It's just to give them the stability of being in a full-day program and to give us time to teach them those social and emotional skills they're going to need before they go to kindergarten." End of article. Next, Labor Day. Picnic turnout shows growing unity. This is by Allison Petty. Decatur. In its third year, the Labor Day Solidarity Picnic in Fairview Park enjoyed its best attendance Monday. More than 2,000 people gathered shortly after the annual parade to feast on barbecue and chicken from Nelson's Catering and ice cream from Mr. Softy, let their children play in bounce houses, and watch the Decatur Power Tumblers perform. The unity is crucial since Republican Bruce Rauner became governor, union leaders said Monday. While they acknowledged differences with former Democratic Governor Pat Quinn, they said Rauner presents a larger threat. "I'd take 5 Quinns over 1 Rauner," said Steve Woosley, chairman of United Transportation Union Local 768. Woosley said public and private sector union members need to stand together, a sentiment echoed throughout the picnic. Carl Draper, president of Decatur Trades and Labor Assembly, said the event has grown from about 1,500 attendees in 2013. He said Labor Day is a great chance to get members of all the unions together to remember their common bond. Rising tides lift all ships, Draper said. When someone's bargaining for a fair wage, it affects everyone. For instance, a non-union building tradesman, when a union tradesman gets a wage increase, they get a wage increase. We set the market. Jane Marquis showed her union pride with a T-shirt featuring Rosie the Riveter. As an employee of the Decatur Correctional Center, Marquis is a member of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Her husband, Kevin, is a member of the Brotherhood of Railroad Carmen, 6277. The couple attends the picnic each year, she said, and there's always plenty for 7-year-old son Aiden to do, too. "Now, more than ever, we as unions have got to stick together," she said. Amy Roof, treasurer of Decatur Trades and Labor Assembly, said she wanted people to know that union members are part of the community and they pull together to give back. The picnic featured the presentation of $17,500 in donation to local charities from the We Are One Community Fund. These aren't thugs. These are people with family and kids and grandkids here, Roof said. We're neighbors and friends and teachers and police and bus drivers and construction workers and citizens of the community, and we're here to stay. End of article. Next headline. Lung transplant candidate keeps upbeat attitude. Decatur. When she arrived for lunch with her former Mount Zion High School classmate, Lisa Gregg carried a bouquet of helium balloons. At 54, David Johnson is a little older than the typical recipient of such a... It wasn't his birthday. Okay. I'm going to stop. At 54, David Johnson is a little older than the typical recipient of such a colorful gift. It also wasn't his birthday. But the balloons were special because they signified his upcoming second chance at life through a double lung transplant. Jensen had told Gregg, with whom he reconnected over Facebook after years out of touch, that he was looking forward to getting his new balloons. And it's an example of the upbeat attitude with which Jensen speaks of his situation. He hopes one day to climb a mountain and beat the 22-year-old record for longest lung transplant survivor through Indiana University Health, where he is on the transplant waiting list. You have to have hope. You have to keep your hopes up. You have to know this is going to work, he said. But first, he wants to raise awareness of the genetic disorder that likely caused him to develop COPD. Alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency commonly leads to liver and lung. The recovery period will require Jensen and Allison to stay in Indianapolis for a month, including 18 to 20 days in the hospital and more time in therapy. Jensen will return for regular visits for the rest of his life, Rose said. Because the risk of rejection never goes away, the 5-year survival rate for transplant patients is just 50%. Jensen is determined to beat the odds and plans to run in a local 5K race after he's recovered from the surgery. If I had not seen these things from others, it wouldn't have given me any hope. It wouldn't have given me the idea I can do anything I want, no matter what's going on with me, he said. Jensen has 3 adult sons from his first marriage, David Jensen Jr., 30, of Lawrence, Kansas, Timothy Jensen, 28, and Dylan Jensen, 23, both of Bethany. His 10-year-old son from his second marriage, Isaac Hartz Jensen, also lives in Lawrence. Because he must be ready to receive new lungs whenever the hospital calls, Jensen has been unable to visit his 2 sons in Kansas as often as he'd like. He was very close to the transplant August 9th, but doctors discovered a lung infection that required Jensen to take antibiotics for 10 days and remain off the list for 4 weeks. He plans to undergo a CT scan Wednesday to determine whether the infection has cleared. In the meantime, he continues to attend pulmonary rehab 3 times a week at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Although his lung capacity has decreased, Jensen said his stamina has improved dramatically since he began the therapy 3 years ago. At that time, he could only walk 356 feet in 6 minutes, which is a test to measure endurance. Now he can walk 1,058. It takes a lot of therapy, a lot of positive thinking, a lot of getting up and doing things when you don't want to do it, he said. As she left to catch her flight back to Florida last month, Gregg turned to Jensen. You're going to have new lungs when I see you again, she said. Yeah, he told her. Are you going to be ready to climb that mountain? End of the article. Next headline. EPA requires detailed sewer study repairs from city. This is by Allison Petty. Decatur. Although the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will require the city of Decatur to conduct a detailed study of its sewer system and make repairs, the demands could have been much greater. That was the bottom line of a presentation to the Decatur City Council on Tuesday when the council heard results in negotiation with the agency that began in 2012. It is expected to vote September 21st on a formal consent order with the agency, a copy of which was not available Tuesday. The agreement will require the city to evaluate program areas of its sewer system and devise solutions to eliminate sanitary sewer overflows and sewer backups into residents' properties, city officials said. But Assistant Corporation Counsel John Robinson said the agency's initial administrative compliance order, issued in August 2012 encompassed a much greater scope. Through negotiations, the city was able to limit the order to specific areas of the sewer system, he said. The city provided the agency with a 2010 sanitary sewer system master plan, sanitary sewer master plan, and 2009 stormwater master plan, showing it had taken some proactive steps to address the issues. Revenue for some repairs became available after the council approved sanitary use fees increased. After the council approved sanitary user fee increases in 2011 and a new storm water utility last year. Seven areas with high inflow and infiltration were identified in the city's sanitary sewer master plan, and the agency agreed that the city could focus the more detailed study on those. The highlighted sections generally are in the areas of Sesame Drive, West Main Street, Florian Avenue, Lynette Drive, Southampton Road, East William Street Road, and Lost Bridge Road. Although the city keeps maps and performs televised inspections of sewer lines, Robinson said important factors such as elevation and slope would need to be assessed. The study would evaluate the capacity of sewer lines in the targeted areas and solutions to increase the capacity if necessary. Public Works Director Rick Marley said the agency's goals aligned with the city's. While city officials have worked to address aging and deteriorating sewers for years, he said limited resources meant improvements did not move as quickly as the agency might have wanted. The agreement would require issues to be identified and solutions to be implemented by December 2018. Because the initial study will not be completed for months, Marley could not provide a potential cost estimate for improvements. He compared the situation to have a check engine light come on in the vehicle. You know you have to take it to the mechanic, and you're really frightened of this because you don't have any idea how much it's going to cost you to get it fixed, he said. But you know you'd better get it fixed. Robinson told the council that it could direct city staff to negotiate for other provisions or could fail to approve an agreement with the agency. He did not recommend either scenario, citing the agency's ability to impose steep fines and take legal action against the city. Councilman Pat McDaniel said he would vote for the agreement. There's no way you want to take on the federal EPA. Marley said residents should not be alarmed, pointing out the agency cannot require the city to make improvements that it cannot afford. There's not a single thing in here that's something that we don't want to do, he said. We want to be good stewards of the city and good stewards of the environment. End of article. Decatur police round up suspects, witnesses in murder. This is by Tony Reed and Allison Petty, staff writers for the Herald and Review. Decatur. Detectives in Decatur investigating the shooting death of one woman and the wounding of another have made three arrests with murder charges expected to follow as they've questioned suspects and witnesses and pursued leads late into the night Tuesday. Police Chief Brad Sweeney said those arrested were men ages 16 to 18, and the case was moving quickly. We're hopeful to have this matter wrapped up. in the next 24 hours, she said Tuesday night. Detectives' frantic activity followed the discovery of the body of 21-year-old Casey E. Taylor, who was gunned down in an apartment at 1450 East Wellington Way at 9:13 Monday. An autopsy showed Taylor was shot twice in the left arm and twice in the chest, with the chest wounds being fatal, according to Macon County Coroner Michael E. Day. The second victim involved, named in police reports, is Brittany Ann Wilson, 20, is being treated at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. It is understood her wounds are serious, but she's expected to recover. Deputy Police Chief Cody Moore said the three suspects in the case had been arrested by his detectives and representatives of the U.S. Marshals Service. More arrests are expected, Moore said. Detectives had said earlier they were still seeking witnesses and would keep searching until they had found everyone they wanted to interview. Police had been working the murder since 9:15 Monday when the first calls came in about shots fired and persons being injured, according to Moore. Upon arrival, officers located two victims. One victim was transported to a local hospital for treatment of gunshot wounds, and the second victim was found to be deceased, Moore said. The investigation of this crime has continued throughout the nighttime hours, and it was determined that this was not a random act and the victims were acquainted with the suspects. Sweeney also said the murder was not a random crime and that Taylor had associations with her killer that reached into her past. That's the end of that article. Next, Phillips says he'll run for re-election. Charleston State Representative Reggie Phillips has announced he's running for a second term, a day after telling the H&R Springfield Bureau that he's so frustrated with the ongoing government stalemate he might relocate to Florida. Phillips, a Republican from Charleston, said he'd taken out options on real estate in the Sunshine State and made other preparations in anticipation of a possible move. "We're very actively looking at it," Phillips told the Bureau late last week, "and I'm a practical businessman. I can't stay here and allow myself to be strangled by incompetence." But Phillips issued a Saturday news release announcing he'll seek a second term as state representative in the 110th District. "I went to Springfield because I am tired of seeing bad policies drive jobs and opportunities away from our state," Phillips said. "I looked at my grandchildren and I wondered what kind of future they will have. The decision to run was based on my desire to turn the state around. I think it's important to have representation in Springfield that is not beholden to campaign contributors or party leaders. I'm an independent voice and I serve the people of the 110th, and I would be honored to continue serving in Springfield for another term," he said. Phillips, who owns a home building and real estate company in Charleston, which he and his wife, Martha, started in 1986, took office in January and was hopeful Republican Governor Bruce Rauner could move quickly to implement his plans to make Illinois a more business-friendly state. But he said, "The fight is a lot harder than what I anticipated." Rauner and the Democrats, who control the House and the Senate, have locked horns over the governor's push to weaken the power of labor unions. The battle has left the state with no budget heading into the third month of the state's fiscal year. A native of Arthur, Phillips and his wife Martha have four adult children and 10 grandchildren. He was elected in 2014 to represent the 110th District, which encompasses parts or all of Coles, Crawford, Lawrence, Cumberland, and Edgar counties. End of article. Next article. Girls allege man tried to lure them into his car. By Tony Reed. Decatur. A 23-year-old Decatur man was arrested Friday evening and charged with attempting to lure teenage girls into his car. Sworn police statements state the suspect pulled up next to four girls between the ages of 14 and 16 as they walked home near Poole Street and Grand Avenue at 8 p.m. The girls were interviewed by detectives, and a sworn police statement gives their version of what happened. The white male pulled up next to him and said something similar to, "Come with me, I got weed and drinks." One 15-year-old girl said she believed the suspect drove up and talked to them because he was trying to lure them to come with him so he could have sex with them. Each of the girls police spoke to gave a similar version of the suspect's approach, and they were able to recall the license number of the suspect's car. A 16-year-old girl told police the suspect drove off after being told no and asked to leave, but he did not drive far. He continued to drive around the areas they were walking in and stared them down, according to the statements. Detectives located the suspect later that evening, and they allege all four victims identified both the suspect and his vehicle. Under questioning, the suspect is alleged to have admitted stopping and talking to the girls as they walked home, but he said he had spoken to them because he recognized them from a previous incident in which his vehicle was damaged. He was booked on charges of attempted child abduction and trying to lure a child victim younger than 17. Bail of $20,000 was set with the condition he had no contact with the girls. He's due in court for arraignment October 6th. End of article. Next, not local, but of local interest, I think. Field Museum extends Mammoths and Mastodons exhibit. This is from AP Chicago. A popular exhibit at Chicago's Field Museum has been extended, giving visitors more time to learn about the Ice Age mammals. The museum announced Tuesday that its Mammoths and Mastodons exhibits will run through January 3rd instead of closing in September as originally planned. The museum is keeping the exhibition running because of its popularity. Mammoths and Mastodons debuted at the Field Museum in 2010 and has toured to other museums. It explores the world of the giant creatures through fossils, prehistoric artwork, and touchable life-size replicas. Visitors learn about the connection between mammoths and mastodons and their modern cousins, elephants. The exhibit requires a separate admission fee. Tickets can be purchased online at the museum's website. End of article. We'll end section one for the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, September 9th, with a little positive information on the Illini. Illini positively moving into week two. Champaign, in his quest to accentuate the positive, interim head coach Bill Cubitt has a long checklist of things his Illini football team did well in his 52-3 season-opening victory over Kent State. By Monday night, he will have talked to the team about every one of them, but Cubitt isn't a man who ignores the negatives, so he has another list to be checking through, too. Like the too many drop passes, like the five pre-snap penalties, like a running game that was good but not great. We have a lot of things we need to get better at, Cubitt said Monday, but I thought our kids came ready to play. We'll talk about Kent State till dinner. After dinner, it's all Western Illinois. Cubitt doesn't wait long to change gears as he moves from one game to the next. He reviews the past performance, talks about where improvements must come, then switches the focus to the upcoming opponent, which in this case is Western Illinois team that mashed Eastern Illinois 33-5 in its opener. But the list of positives is a long one, and Cubitt will relish reminding his team of the tasks they performed well in his first game as Illinois' head coach. We played 73 guys, almost everyone who was eligible we didn't want to redshirt, he began. 28 different players made tackles. We had 14 tackles behind the line of scrimmage. 10 different players caught passes. 6 different guys caught touchdown passes. 5 running backs carried the ball. We got redshirt freshman quarterback Chase Crouch a lot of time. We have some young players who, when they see the tape, will understand what it takes to play major college football. We gave up only one big play on defense, and that was a major emphasis. And we had 3 touchdown drives that lasted one play, and that's a first in my career. It is possible that each week something new will become apparent as part of the personal stamp Cubitt is trying to put on the program now that it's under his watch. On Monday, players noted that Cubitt had shortened practices while increasing the tempo. We're getting as much done, but it doesn't take as long, defensive lineman Rob Bain said. Another personal change is Cubitt's attempt to connect directly with the fans. Last week, he made a surprise appearance on the quad, talking with students and even selling tickets. He liked the interaction and plans to go back there on Thursday. Before Saturday's kickoff, the team lined up in the west hash mark, raised their helmets, and marched toward the east stands. Cubitt said it was a salute to family, friends, and fans who support the team at Memorial Stadium. Then the team turned and saluted those sitting on the west stands. Rather than complain about the small attendance on hand for Saturday's game, Cubitt pointed out that the postponement Friday night made it difficult for many to attend, so he focused on praising those who witnessed the Illinois rout. And I'll be back on the quad because that's how I can help. If people look at what we're trying to do and see our attitude, that's a lot of good things to accomplish here. Hopefully the future is bright for us. I'm not going to stop until this place is packed. End of that article. End of part one. Talk to you soon.